This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Scott Rafferty, who's an attorney in Mountain View, California. Welcome to California Politics Today.
How are you, Mark?
I'm good. Tell us a little bit about your background politically and legally.
Well, I am a lawyer, and I have a PhD in economics from Oxford University, where I was a Rhodes Scholar. I moved to California in 2001, and I... And politically, I've always been a registered Democrat, although this is not a partisan issue and isn't related to any campaign.
Speaking of any campaign, you have a position or involved with the Kerry campaign in California?
Well, I was on John Kerry's steering committee during the primary,
right?
Which is basically a legal position representing him to the Secretary of State. It's not the most influential position in the campaign.
Right.
I was an at-large delegate to the national convention, and I've been elected a county committee person to the Santa Clara County Democratic Party.
Okay, all that notwithstanding, you want to say this is a legal, not a partisan case that you're
involved absolutely. In. At the time I filed this case, I didn't even know the party affiliations of my clients. In fact, I only know the party affiliation of one since then because he happens to have mentioned it.
Right. Okay, now this case is called Bridgman versus Shelley. We all know that Shelley is Kevin Shelley in his role as Secretary of State of California. Who's Bridgman?
Tess Bridgman grew up in Santa Cruz, went to Stanford University, has voted in Santa Cruz in every election since she became 18, with the exception of the recall when she was working at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and did not get an absentee ballot. She is in Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship.
Is that how you came to know her, because you were in Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship?
Yes, we have a lot of mutual friends through that connection.
Right.
And at the time that the complaint or the petition was written, she had not received her absentee ballot. It actually came the morning the petition was filed, so that was noted in the petition.
Okay. Now, are there other are they claimants, litigants? What's the legal?
Well, I guess their formal title is petitioner, because this is a petition for a writ of mandate.
Okay. Are there other petitioners besides Tess Bridgman?
Yes.
And you're representing them all. So you're representing the whole class of people.
Yeah. Well, the whole there are three of them.
Okay. Who are the other two?
Edwin Lau is a resident of Mountain View, California.
Right.
He lives in Paris.
Right.
Where he is serving his country as a civil servant in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development.
Okay.
And he had not received his ballot materials either,
right.
And planned to vote through the federal emergency ballot,
right.
Which enables you to vote for President, Senate, and Congress.
Right.
And the third petitioner is John Doe, who really represents everybody in the military and other civil servants who have confidentiality concerns, which are so strong they don't want their identity to be disclosed,
right.
At all, because to say that you're insisting on voting privately to many people is to indicate that you are voting contrary to the expectations of your commanding officer or the desires of your commanding officer, and that they just don't want to identify that they have this concern.
Which is pretty much what the issue at stake is.
Exactly.
Okay. When did you file, and where did you file, and what did you ask for?
Well, I filed in the Supreme Court of California and asked for a declaration that this particular provision was unconstitutional that requires you to waive your secrecy as a condition of faxing back your vote.
Okay, before we talk about whether it's constitutional or not, where did this provision and opportunity to send a ballot come from, and what were the terms and conditions associated with it?
Governor Schwarzenegger signed a bill, I believe on August 27th, which is in the middle of the voting season, actually,
right.
Because absentee ballots go out early in August overseas.
Right, so this was after the procedure had started. For sending out ballots.
There's some uncertainty. It appears that some registrars were accepting fax ballots before the bill became law.
Right.
And that they were doing so with the permission of Kevin Shelley, who had repeatedly declared over the years that this was illegal because of the secrecy issue.
And were they requiring, obviously they weren't requiring secrecy waivers?
It appears actually that they may have been, that they were doing this on an ad hoc basis.
Right.
And that they, it appears that many of them were, but, you know, they're 67 different counties in California.
58 actually.
Sorry. Right. We're not exactly sure what was going on in each county.
Right. Okay. And in fact, I think when I looked over some of the material from the assembly member who wrote the bill, Patricia Bates, part of the motivation for that was to standardize the procedures across the state.
Yes, and of course, if you read Bush v. Gore, that's a very important requirement of the U.S. Constitution.
Right, that the voting procedures be the same in all the counties within the state.
So Governor Schwarzenegger signed this law, and within a week, we were in court to say, well, if these are the rules, they're really not okay.
Okay.
The Secretary of State is in a peculiar position here because for years and years he and his predecessors had said we can't allow faxes unless we guarantee the secrecy of what is transmitted.
Right. Part of the principle is if people can fax in from Paris or Iraq, there's no reason why they can't fax in from Studio City or San Mateo, probably.
Well, there are actually that's a separate issue because the statute is written in great haste,
right?
And against the advice of the Legislative Council, and it has a lot of sloppiness. And one of the issues is if you are overseas at the time you request or fill out an affidavit, it doesn't matter if you come back to the States. You can fax from your bedroom.
In other words, that quality sort of adheres in you even though you're not far away.
Exactly. So if any time during the election season you go to Tijuana and fill out this affidavit, there's nothing in the bill that says you can't come back to the United States, be in the United States on election day, and fax the ballot from your bedroom. In fact, one could even argue, you know, if you fly to Boston from San Francisco or you fly to Houston from Los Angeles, you go over international airspace, and you could fill out the affidavit while you're on the plane. That's how broadly and, frankly, sloppily this bill is written.
Well, speaking of sloppily, it also seems to say both that you need to sign an oath that says you're waiving your right to the secrecy of your ballot, and then in the immediate paragraph after that, it says that the election officials shall take all due steps in order to preserve the secrecy of the faxed ballot, doesn't it?
Exactly. And as one of the registrars has pointed out to me, you know, it's simple. First of all, they're all sworn to secrecy. Extent that someone in there's already a process with regular absentee ballots where you take the ballot out of the envelope and staple it to the back of the envelope, and all those people have a theoretical opportunity to figure out how people are voting. They're sworn not to, and the fact that they have that opportunity has never been seen to violate secrecy. And as I said, one of the registrars told me, it's the same process. We get something off the fax machine. It's in two pages. We take page two, the ballot, stick it in an envelope. We staple the identifying information to the outside of the envelope, and then we treat it like every other absentee ballot. So this notion that it's obvious that people have to waive their privacy is just wrong. So
you're saying as the process exists in real time and space, there already are opportunities for paper absentee ballots. There's an opportunity for a violation of secrecy, but it isn't a problem because it isn't done because the people in charge there and their employees are ethical enough not to do it?
Well, they're not only ethical enough not to do it, but it's a felony. It's a felony. If you're in the state of California, and especially if you're an election official, and everything an election official does, I mean, literally, any citizen has a right to walk into the registrar of voters and watch them all day long while they open these envelopes. If you try to compromise a ballot secrecy, which you have an opportunity to do, you know, you've committed a felony. The problem is the state of California has no ability to enforce that against what goes on in Iraq.
Right.
And furthermore, neither the state of California nor possibly the federal government has any authority over these people in Alexandria, Virginia, who are running the fax forwarding system.
Right. Now, let me try to, before we get too deeply into the morass of the complications here, in a report, several reports that I was doing earlier this week, this company you just referred to, Omega Corporation, came up as part of what I was looking into in Missouri and peripherally in Utah and North Dakota, where the FVAP, the Federal Voting Assistance Program, which is part of the Pentagon, had set this up with those three states using the Omega Corporation in, presumably, in, they're in Alexandria, Virginia, to receive scanned PDF'd ballots from military personnel and then convert them to faxes to be sent to individual local voting authorities. Now, where does California come in relation to those three other states?
Let me try to understand this.
Yes.
There are PDFs that are being sent from overseas to
the Pentagon slash Omega, yes.
By email.
Not by email, because I asked them about that, and an early version of the report that I put up on the website used the term internet. Apparently, it's not the internet; it's what's called the Electronic Transmission Service, which is essentially a Pentagon intranet, which is proprietary and supposedly secure, so that there isn't the issues that scuttled the SIR voting system. That the internet itself was intrinsically incapable of supporting a secure remote internet voting system. I asked them about that, and they said, no, it wasn't. Nothing happens on the internet. It happens on the Electronic Transmission Service, which, as best as I can figure out, is a intranet belonging to the Pentagon and controlled by it and used only by it. So that soldiers who apparently have better access to personal computers, scanners, and the electronic transmission service than they do to fax machines connected to phone lines, are able to take their paper absentee ballot, or maybe now that the Pentagon is issuing these federal ballots, the federal emergency ballots, over the internet, they can print those out and fill them out and scan them, PDF them, send them by electronic transmission to Omega, and have those sent to their files to the appropriate election officials in the localities. So that's where things stand from what the Pentagon's been saying.
My understanding of how this bill works is that it allows the voted ballots to be faxed and received by fax in the registrar's office.
Yes, that's what the California law provides.
It doesn't actually say that it has to be faxed by the voter or from overseas.
Right.
And one of the risks here is, you know, because the whole idea of ballot secrecy, it's not somebody's individual right. You know, it's not my right to vote in secret. It's my responsibility to vote in secret. Because before we had ballot secrecy, we had basically election by auction, where people would display their ballots and they would be paid for how they voted.
And in fact, it's that necessity that has spurred on a lot of the controversies about touchscreen voting and receipts, and complicated the effort to get paper trails, voter verifiable paper trails for touchscreens, because you can't issue a receipt showing how a person voted to that person, because then they can go outside and either allay the fears of the bully who forced them to vote away a certain way, or collect money from someone who's bribed them to vote a certain way. So that's where the secrecy comes in and is so crucial.
Exactly. And this basically restores the pre-ballot secrecy situation, and it would allow it basically would allow someone in Southern California to drive a group of people across the border and say, you know, sign this affidavit, drive them back, and then say, okay, here's your ballot, fill it out and give it to me, and sometime between now and Election Day, I'm going to fax it in, and you know, here's your $10.
So you're saying that that's allowed by this legislation?
Bribery is not allowed,
right?
But the opportunities for coercion and bribery are restored.
Okay. Now, did you ask for the excision or the declaration of unconstitutionality of the whole law, or just the waiver of secrecy provision?
No, what we asked for very specifically,
right,
is that the oath, which is the secrecy waiver, is contained in an oath of voter, and it differs from the normal state absentee oath, and it differs from the federal oath, because it contains this waiver of secrecy.
Okay.
It's not a separate document. It has to be in the oath. If it's not in the oath, your vote doesn't count. And we said this oath has two problems. First of all, it's substantively unconstitutional because it requires this ballot waiver,
right,
which cannot be properly entered into by the voter.
So, in fact, as I asked someone else, I think it was the spokesperson for the Secretary of State in Missouri, the right to secrecy is an inalienable right.
That would be my position as well.
Right.
I think it's an inalienable right, and it's also a responsibility of the voter.
Okay.
Now, the second reason it's illegal is that the oath is simply different than the federal oath, and that's every state has to allow the use of the federally prescribed oath. Hava in 2002 said, look, if we're going to make this work in the military, they can't have 51 different forms for voters out there in the field.
Right.
So the Secretary of Defense is going to come up with a standard federal oath, which basically says, you know, I am who I say I am. And ironically, it also says I haven't been coerced.
Right.
And I'm voting, you know, basically says I've maintained the secrecy of this ballot.
Right.
So because the California oath is different than the federal oath, it's a violation of federal law. Now, the California Supreme Court, in their decision, said we don't contest the entire oath. Actually, we do. We do contest any word in the oath that differs from the federal oath, for the simple reason that if you use the federal oath instead of the California oath, which people will naturally do,
right,
then under the literal provisions of the law, your vote won't count.
Does the federal oath require the waiver of secrecy as well?
No.
Oh, okay.
The if you use the government's fax network,
right,
then they ask you on a separate piece of paper to waive secrecy. So there are two different secrecy waivers here for California voters.
Right.
And that's problematic as well. But we're focusing on the fact that under California law, even if you use your own fax machine and fax directly to the registrar of voters, your vote doesn't count unless you waive your secrecy.
Do you have to waive it twice, once under the federal provision, once
if
under the state?
If you use the federal
phone number,
fax system,
right,
the federal phone number, toll-free phone number, you have to waive it twice.
Let me ask something very obvious. Why is there the requirement that the secrecy be waived at all, given what you said about the fact that the secrecy could be violated but isn't because it's protected by other provisions of law?
Well, it was protected by other the provisions of law, certainly continues to be at the receiving end. But when you sign a waiver that is worded as this one is,
right,
you have waived all of your rights under the Federal Privacy Act. That's why when you apply for a ballot, in fact, there's a long, you know, the usual Privacy Act disclosure about we will only use this information for the following purposes.
Right.
But when you vote your ballot, that all goes away, and you are waiving your right to privacy, not only the privacy of how you vote, but also your address, your email address. All of that can be used hypothetically by the Secretary of Defense, but more realistically by Omega Technologies, which could start marketing email lists that were targeted to how people voted, and could use their addresses for commercial purposes. So all of your rights under the Federal Privacy Act are extinguished by your waiver.
In fact, your ballot could be published on the internet.
They could send out press releases
with your name and
a
facsimile of your ballot.
Fallen soldiers voted to you know, against President Bush.
Right.
And they live. They come from your neighborhood, and here's their names
and their addresses.
That's right. And their email addresses.
And
so let them know how you feel.
Right. And that could be done while the election is still going on, as an intimidation to other people who may think of doing the same thing.
Exactly. So it's not an imaginary problem. It's a real potential for intimidation. And FOIA is a very secretive organization. It doesn't, the No Fear Act that protects federal whistleblowers.
Right.
It doesn't apply to this contractor, and the terms of the contract have not been disclosed by DOD, even though I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, which they're going to stonewall until after the election.
What do you know about Omega Corporation, besides that they're in Alexandria, Virginia, which is just
they're
down
Alexandria,
the street from,
Virginia,
from the Pentagon?
They've had some contract disputes in the past,
right,
that have been reported in the New York Times.
Right.
And we know that their CEO is named Patricia Williams, who is a senior fundraiser with the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee.
Has the company given money to the Bush campaign?
I don't know. Well, of course, the company is a corporation,
right.
So I haven't gone through, you know, all of their executives, but
right.
I mean, it's fair to say that if you're a senior person on the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, that you are, in fact, not only giving your own money, but you're encouraging other people to do the same.
Was this a no-bid contract?
Yes.
This is reminiscent of the head of Diebold, who promised the Ohio vote for President Bush.
Well, it's worse than that, because Congress, Congress saw this coming. Congress said, we don't want to have a repetition where we fight about this after the election.
Right.
So they said to the that the Election Assistance Commission, which they were creating,
right,
would by April 2004 issue a report on about a dozen issues. Two of those issues were how to maintain ballot secrecy and how to maintain the security and privacy of ballots that were cast by fax.
Right.
And that report was not issued as required by law. The Election Assistance Commission said that Secretary Rumsfeld held it up and they were required to consult with him. It came out about 2 weeks ago. Sometime in September, actually.
And what did it mainly say?
And the answer to the questions is, well, if you vote by fax, you have to waive your secrecy. So it wasn't really the what Congress was expecting, and it certainly wasn't timely for Congress to do anything about it. And in the interim, the Secretary of Defense, who'd been too busy to comply with the law, put out a no-bid contract, basically insulating the people who were doing the fax forwarding from all the legal requirements that would apply if this was done as a military operation by the Department of Defense employees themselves. So whistleblower protections don't apply, Freedom of Information Act doesn't apply, none of the protections apply, and Ms. Williams doesn't give interviews to anyone.
Was there a legal reason why the Pentagon outsourced this process and didn't have its own highly trained staff to do it?
Well, I can't get inside the mind of Secretary Rumsfeld, but it certainly achieves an insulation from all of the legal requirements which apply to federal employees.
Without stretching it too much, is that like contracting security in Iraq to private companies that are not liable under the laws of the United States?
Well,
that apply to military.
It's an analogous situation, except in this case, it could determine the outcome of a presidential election,
which in part would determine the continuation of the war in Iraq. Under what terms and conditions that happens? So
it would determine a lot of matters.
Okay, let's focus a little bit on the logistics of what happened. How did you get? Is it possible to have original jurisdiction in the California Supreme Court the way you did?
It's very, very rare that the California Supreme Court looks at these things.
Right.
Normally, you go to in similar situations you would go to the Superior Court in Sacramento County, which has venue over plain vanilla election disputes that come up at the last, you know. But the problem here is that when you raise a constitutional issue, under the California Constitution, the Secretary of State or any official can't comply with an order of a trial court without taking it to an appellate court, whether that's a state appellate court or a federal appellate court. So as a practical matter, this meant that we couldn't solve the problem before the election unless the California Supreme Court intervened. So that's why it was appropriate to go to the California Supreme Court. It's been done before. You know, I, in fact, filed a petition to the California Supreme Court during the recall, as did four other attorneys on various issues. And all of those petitions were rejected outright. You know, they didn't say, we'll think about it after the election. They just said, we have discretion not to hear this at all, and we're exercising that discretion without regard to the merits of the case.
Right. Without trying to build this up too much, I finished reading a pretty good article a few weeks ago in Vanity Fair about the Florida elections in 2000, and it sounds like we're pretty much back in that same frame of mind and state and situation that hovered all over Florida in 2000 in terms of the Supreme Court's getting involved and the arguments and the back and forth. It sounds like 2000 has arrived early in 2004.
Well, the reason we hoped to resolve this early was we were hoping that there could be a clear vindication, and of course my clients are from California and I'm a member of the California Bar, so. But logically, if it applies if it's unconstitutional under the California state constitution, every state in the country has similar provisions either in the constitution or in statute, then the Secretary of Defense needs to take his separate waiver, you know, off the table and tell people that they can vote by fax with every assurance that their confidentiality will be maintained. And it's unfortunately the case that, particularly if we take the federal backup ballot,
which is a ballot
where people, you know, haven't received ballot materials. In case California, they won't know about the requirements for the oath.
Right.
They'll naturally use the federal oath, and their votes won't count, which is absurd. Even if they sign the separate federal waiver, according to Secretary Shelley. But this applies, the Secretary's waiver applies beyond just California, and a disproportionate number of military soldiers and officers are residents of the two states which give them tax advantages. And those two states are Texas, which probably doesn't matter in this election, and Florida. Which is an extremely close race.
Two states with Bush governors at one point.
So it is a matter of concern, because after the election, we won't be able to figure out what the impact is. There'll be people who didn't vote because they didn't like the system, or they were afraid to vote openly, and they'll simply try to avoid voting rather than cast a vote that is against their conscience.
Right. So again, as in Florida, I want to drag out the analogies, though. People who were kept from voting in the first, apart from misreading of ballots, people who were kept from voting by various regulations or procedures that intimidated or annoyed or bored them to the point where they said, we're not going to participate, and it's like you can't tell how many stayed away on that basis.
No, but what we will be able to tell is that in California, for example, if your vote doesn't get here until 8 p.m. on election day,
right,
then it doesn't count. So we will be able to tell that every single ballot which arrives by mail after election day,
right,
is a vote that could have been faxed if two conditions existed. First of all, if there was no privacy waiver to intimidate people, and secondly, if the requirements, the opportunity to fax and the requirements of how to do that were adequately publicized. And neither the Secretary of State's website or the Federal Voter Assistance Project website has the oath that you have to sign. The only way a voter could become aware of that oath is if they do research on the legislature's website and actually read the statute cover to cover.
So not only is it wrong, not only are you arguing that it's wrong to require the provision, but you're saying that the provision's requirement isn't being publicized, so the people who use this means of voting will have their votes automatically disqualified.
And yes, and it will either not use it, but not be aware that there's a faxing opportunity at all,
right?
Or will do it in a way that causes their votes not to be counted. And what's so troubling about that is this is a recipe for selectively making information available in Iraq. And in fact, it's unclear under the law. We can't have active campaigning,
right,
among the military. That's a taboo.
Right.
But it's unclear that you can have active campaigning among National Guard units that are activated.
Right.
So in National Guard units, you know exactly where they come from.
Yes.
So if there's a National Guard unit from, say, Senate District 15, which is a very close race,
right,
the partisans can go and campaign with the National Guard, and or with both the National Guard and the military, they can figure out, you know, where their target population is, and they can tell them, the military can tell them this week, which is get out the vote week in the military,
right,
they can say, well, you need to know, it's not on the website, but you need to know, here's a way that you can vote and get your ballot in before election day that we're not going to tell these other soldiers about because we don't think they're going to vote the right way.
Well,
So this whole idea of changing the election rules in the middle of the casting of ballots,
right,
is just, to me, a corruption of the way we ought to be administering elections.
Okay, now did you make all these arguments in front of the Supreme Court, or were you only heard in a brief?
We were only heard in the brief.
Summarize the main points that you made in the brief.
The main points we made were, you know, fax voting is good, it expands the opportunities to vote, and it is completely practicable to have the faxes cast with an assurance and requirement that the votes be maintained confidential.
So there's no need for the oath abjuring or waiving the right to secrecy.
Yes.
Which doesn't add anything substantive to the process, but in fact opens up the voter to all kinds of abuses.
Yes.
Okay.
And the second argument we made was, furthermore, this is a violation of federal law, and the California court can decide an issue of federal law. We could have gone straight to federal court.
Right. We'll get to that in a second.
And the reason there is that this oath is different than the oath that people are entitled to use,
right,
especially those people who don't have, who did not receive their ballots on time or at all and are therefore casting the emergency ballot.
Okay. So you made those arguments, and then what were the arguments in response by Secretary Shelley? What position was he or his office arguing?
Well, his response was, this is a lot of trouble, and if you decided, he seemed to throw up the scenario where the Supreme Court decided now to grant immediate relief and say, don't make people sign these oaths, and then change their mind after the election.
I'm sorry. He was arguing that the court should do what?
That if the court granted, a stay and said we have to count these votes, we have to receive these votes now, and changed its mind.
Right.
After a full briefing.
Right.
That it would disenfranchise people who thought they were voting but actually weren't voting, because the Secretary of State would retroactively apply the Supreme Court's new decision to disenfranchise people who voted legally and in accordance with the Supreme Court order. It was a very contorted argument, especially from Kevin Shelley, who, when it suits him, he, in the recall where there was a challenge which was unfavorable to Governor Davis about whether abstainers could vote,
right,
he went into federal court and agreed to brief something in 8 days and got a permanent injunction in 8 days. So it's one of these cases where, unfortunately, and The Secretary of State, which of course is an office, it's not just an individual. So
right.
It's not Kevin Shelley individually making these decisions.
Right.
But has just ducked an issue.
So was he arguing that he should not be forced, his office and electors or election officials around the state should not be forced to receive faxed ballots without waivers because essentially it would confuse the people who thought they had to sign them? Is that what he was arguing?
And he was actually arguing, I know this is hard to state, it was hard for me to understand, I had to read it a number of times.
Right.
That if the Supreme Court said, yes, you can vote now.
Without the waiver.
Without the waiver.
Right.
And then, you know, we'll have further briefing on this and make a permanent decision.
Right.
He was then saying, well, if the Supreme Court then agreed with us that this was constitutional after the election, then all of those votes, say 50 people voted,
right,
or more than 50 people in a particular race, say whatever the number is, all those votes would be challengeable. So, and that would potentially undo the results of elections after the fact.
So we needed to the whole governing structure needed to err on the side of waiving the secrecy rights in order to guard against the chance that the Supreme Court later would say that you needed to waive your secrecy rights.
Yes, and the second argument that was made, which I found very, very troubling, and this was made in the legislature as well, was that somehow this law was necessary to protect the people in the registrar's office from accusations that they had violated people's privacy. And that's wrong for two reasons. First of all, the job of the Secretary of State and the registrar's office is to protect the voter.
Right.
And the voter's right to vote. I mean,
right.
That just has absolute primacy. And secondly, we shouldn't be protecting the registrar from, or anybody working for the registrar, from accusations that they violated people's privacy.
Right.
They already have the opportunity to do that with conventional votes, and if they're doing that with fax votes, obviously the charge should be well grounded, but. You know, we shouldn't be requiring people to waive their legal rights when the purpose of that is not only is to insulate a public employee not only from their obligations to that individual, but from their obligations to the public in general to act in a non-corrupt fashion. So I found that argument rather baffling.
Okay, so how did the justices find the different arguments, and what did they finally rule?
They ordered the Secretary of State to show cause why the provision was not unconstitutional.
Right. So that means the burden of proof is now on him to prove that it's not unconstitutional?
Yes. The burden of proof is on him, and that is a very unusual step for the Supreme Court to take. So I think that's a clear signal that the law is in fact unconstitutional and will be found unconstitutional. But they said that it was impossible to fashion interim relief without creating a great deal of uncertainty before the election.
Do you believe that? Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that because I think, in fact, if they, let me put it differently. If
right.
they say, you know, this is the law until after the election, not only after the election, but after the election is certified,
right.
then, you know, I accept the law is what the Supreme Court says it is. So as to state races, where there could be close races, I am anticipating a rather strong argument to be made that votes that, that the law, that noncompliance with the law to the extent that disqualifies votes, it's going to be a challenge to change the results of elections based on what happened.
Right now, this is in a sense a prospective lawsuit, right? Your clients haven't voted yet, have they?
I believe one of my clients I haven't spoken to in the last couple of days, But I believe two of my clients may have voted today.
After and did they sign the waiver?
No, they express mailed or couriered back their ballots because they primarily want to vote.
Oh, they didn't use the fax system.
No,
they sent
it. They wanted to.
Right.
You know, they wanted to, but actually, I think one of my clients hasn't voted yet, but intends to. I mean,
okay.
You know, the fact of the matter is, I want to make sure my clients vote and their votes are counted. And if that means they have to spend $50 to, you know, FedEx it back to the registrar,
right?
You know, they're going to do that. But that doesn't mean that the law is constitutional, and it doesn't mean that other people, particularly in Iraq,
right.
on soldiers' salaries, are, you know, going to. I mean, the whole. I mean, another perspective on this is, why can't the military get ballots back in 48 hours? You know, why can't they encourage people to stick their stuff not in the mail, where you don't get any kind of receipt or audit trail,
right.
but why can't they, you know, in worst case, if they can't do it themselves, if you arrive with a box full of ballots in Baghdad by 4 p.m. Thursday, that would be October 28th.
Right.
It can be transported to any major metropolitan area in the United States to arrive by Monday, that's the day before Election Day,
right.
at 10 a.m. So, you know, if they have these concerns about faxing, they should be encouraging people to vote on paper, and they should physically transport those in envelopes.
Right.
So, you know, it's just the choices that the Secretary of Defense has made in every instance make possible manipulation, intimidation, selective disclosure. You know, he's kept accurate information off the website, and frankly, the Secretary of State has done the same thing too. If you look at overseas voting, none of these issues on the Secretary of State's website, you know, none of these issues are identified. It doesn't really tell you how to vote. So it's not designed to encourage overseas voters to vote. So really, in a realistic way, even though the presidential race and the Senate race and perhaps all but one congressional race in the state are all but decided,
right.
We can infer, you know, there are 500,000 voting-age Californians, or somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 voting-age Californians living overseas.
Right.
Now, I'm prepared to bet that very few of them are going to be able to effectively cast votes this year. And that means that the results of any race are potentially affected by this, except perhaps the presidency and maybe Barbara Boxer, who may win by a larger margin than that, but it's just wrong to disenfranchise people, and you know, it's I respect that the Supreme Court is on our side substantively, and I respect the fact that they have taken the extraordinary step of ordering the Secretary of State to show cause, but it's wrong of the legislature and the governor to pass legislation at such a time that it can't effectively be challenged in the judicial system before an election.
Okay, before we get back to court, let's get to spend some time over at the legislature. I looked at the co-authors of the bill. The both houses of the California legislature, of course, are dominated by the Democratic Party. The author and all the co-authors on the Senate and Assembly side on this bill were Republicans. Why did the Democratic dominated legislature pass it?
Well, if you read the sponsors' claims about the bill,
right.
This bill is necessary to ensure that our fighting men can vote.
Right.
Not necessarily vote their conscience.
Right.
But vote.
Right.
And the rhetoric behind that was just so powerful. And, you know, no politician before an election wants to go on record as being against anybody's right to vote.
None did. It passed in the Assembly in the final vote 78-0.
It passed unanimously. And it passed unanimously despite the fact that the legislative council basically told them that it was unconstitutional.
Right.
If you look at any of the reports on this bill, there's a disclosure by the legislative council that is, in fact, most of my brief was a quotation from the legislative council's own analysis. They said, everything I've told you, you know, this has been in the California Constitution, it's not a waivable right, and it's not merely a right, it's a responsibility, and it's there to protect the public. And, you know, they said in almost unequivocal terms, this is unconstitutional.
It's also unconstitutional, I think, to allow the president to declare war, which is what Congress did. And it seems like this is another example of the pushing through of legislation with justification, principally an appeal to emotion, that says, if you're a patriot, you're going to vote for this, and if you don't, you're not. And then we end up with both the war and a voting regulation tied to it that may be less than optimal.
Well, moving back to the Senate,
right.
The Senate, only five people voted against it.
Right.
Of those five people, four are not running for re-election.
Right.
And the only person running for re-election who dared to vote against this bill, I report, is Tom McClintock.
Well, that's the most honest man in California politics.
Well, that certainly speaks well of him.
Right.
But, you know, we know that after the election, legislators are going to have a different perspective on this and be more willing to say, no, we really don't like opportunities for bribery or opportunities for intimidation. But they're not prepared to make these complicated arguments when they can be branded as being against the right of the military to vote.
Right.
And that's what courts are for. That's why we
right.
have, you know, courts to review things that legislators do, when in a way this is a case where the individual interest of the legislator in appearing a certain way before an election is not consistent with changing the California Constitution. And that's why we have a Constitution, to protect the legislature from doing things that are in their short-term best interests.
Okay, are you going to appeal this to a state or federal court now?
I mean, it's unlikely we can do that before the election, especially because my individual clients, at least two of them, are in a position where they are capable of voting by other means
right.
with sufficient expenditure of funds.
Is that going to render moot the order of the court that the Secretary of State needs to show cause?
Okay.
That stands, whatever.
No, the court made very clear they want this decided before the next election.
Right.
And I don't think it renders moot the issue for a post. Unfortunately, it's this California Supreme Court saying, as other courts have in the past, hold the election and we'll see what happens after that. The California Supreme Court doesn't rule out that there could be post-election challenges.
Right.
I mean, I think that's unfortunate not to decide it before the election.
Right.
But it does, I think it creates the uncertainty that the Supreme Court claims that it is avoiding.
How so?
Because after the election, if you have a close race, you can say, well, here are registered voters who are living overseas who did not vote or whose ballots were received in the mail after the election, after I lost the election.
Right.
And in that context, it doesn't actually matter how the people voted. It's just it's a numbers game.
Right.
If you lose by 100 votes and you find 120 people who are disenfranchised, then you've got a valid election contest. So it creates uncertainty about the results. And, similarly, I don't think the fact that nobody's challenged this in Florida or Missouri or any of the other close states before the election necessarily means that there won't be disputes if they're relevant after the election.
So, follow up on that and put this in context. For example, Oregon votes only by absentee ballot now, by paper absentee ballot. I don't know whether you know, I know I don't, whether or not fax ballots are allowed in Oregon. But there's been a general trend across the country to more absentee voting, making it possible to become a permanent absentee voter and so on. How does this factor in with that to allow or to encourage other state legislatures to do this for domestic fax voting as well? Or is there no compelling argument there because the postal system is assumed to be good enough to ensure people's paper ballot delivery?
Well, I think in most of those states there is an opportunity to physically deliver it yourself.
Right.
If you choose to do so. And of course you have time to register the mail or whatever you may need to do to achieve that. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody has proposed to have fax voting for domestic votes.
Except as you indicated, if a person is overseas,
yes,
which could be...
The bill is so sloppy that it basically allows any kind of absence from the country during pretty much at any time,
right,
to entitle you to vote by fax in the next election.
For example, people going to Canada to buy discounted drugs could fill out these forms as well while they happen to be there and were waiting for their prescriptions to be filled.
That's the way I read this this law. And by the way, in response to your specific thing, Oregon is not one of the states. But if you sort of think of other states that are in play,
right,
voted ballots can be faxed back in Arizona, in Colorado, in Florida, Indiana is not really in play.
These are faxed back from overseas, you mean?
From overseas. Now,
right.
We're talking about overseas voters, although the definition in California appears to be a little sloppy.
And is there any distinction here? One of your clients is a member of the active military, right?
Well, I can't, the
John Doe
person. Go beyond what's in the
competition.
He's just completely anonymous.
Is there a distinction or at any point here between people who are in the military in Iraq and people who are expats in Paris?
There's almost no distinction in the law. The law was drafted to treat civilians and military almost exactly equally.
Right.
Except a civilian can vote for federal officers in a state in which he does not have a tax home. So if you just want to vote for president and you haven't lived in the United States for 20 years,
right,
you can do that in a state where you had previous contacts without exposing yourself to taxation.
And as we
military can't necessarily do that.
They have to vote in the state that they're based in.
As their domicile, but that is often not the state where they actually intend to go back or have lived in the past.
And as we know, a presidential vote in Florida is more important or counts for more than a presidential vote in, say, California or New York, where the result, and under the Electoral College system.
But most of the military who choose to live in Florida have done so for reasons other than strategic voting.
Right, but is there, for these people who say haven't been in the U.S. for 20 years, what state does their vote count? You see, because it counts for more or less depending on which state it counts in, right?
Well, the law says that it's the state in which they were most recently resident, but that's a very unclear term.
Okay.
So it's pretty much any state in which it's not literally applied to mean that, if your plane stopped in Kennedy Airport, that doesn't mean you can only vote in New York.
Right. Taking this all together, what are the scenarios going forward that you think could happen based on these issues? Where would you like to see these issues, in what direction would you like to see these issues resolved? What do you think is going
to
happen?
Well, I've asked the Secretary of State to work with to use his influence with the Secretary of Defense to both publicize the requirements and to eliminate the fax waiver.
Right. This is Kevin Shelley and Donald Rumsfeld. You
Yeah.
You want to have?
I believe that basically, I think Kevin Shelley is wrong to take the position that someone voting the emergency ballot who has never received California ballot materials, who has no way of knowing about the California secrecy oath, should have their vote not counted because they use the federal ballot.
Because left to its own devices, that's what's going to happen. California voters using the emergency ballot that the Pentagon has just agreed to do, according to the Time, the New York Times, because of pressure from the Democratic and Republican parties, will have his or her ballot thrown out when it gets here.
That's right. And I think that's a ridiculous position.
And the remedy for that, as you see it, is what?
Well, I think three things should happen. First of all, the Shelley should urge the Department of Defense to eliminate its separate waiver.
Okay. And can that be done?
For California and all other states.
Can that be done by fiat, by Secretary Rumsfeld?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. He should, in my view, revise his position that he won't count votes that use the federal oath. But if he's not going to do that, he needs to make sure that his own website and the Secretary of Defense's website make very clear to anybody who is voting by fax and is fortunate enough to land in one of those places that they exactly what they have to do to have their vote counted. And as matters stand, he's done neither. And that creates a situation where whether your vote counts depends on exactly what the military in the field chose to tell you about how you were supposed to cast it. And that is a very dangerous situation that is an invitation to manipulate the voting results.
Which is what is supposedly being prevented or diminished by this legislation, but
right.
It's having the opposite effect, according to you. So what does the Secretary of Defense need to do, in your view, to make things as good as possible again?
Well, the first priority would be to eliminate the secrecy oath.
Okay.
He also needs to do a much better job of getting out the vote in a nonpartisan fashion. And of course, he'll say they're doing that.
Right.
This is, you know, get out the vote week, they need to get out the vote without making it clear that it needs to be cast in secret is worse than not getting out the vote at all. And the fact that the Secretary himself is requiring people to sign this waiver is a pretty clear indication to all the subordinate field officers that whether you're casting your vote by fax or by mail, there is no secret ballot in the military anymore.
Right.
And although it remains theoretically a criminal offense to intimidate a soldier in the way they vote, I'm not betting that that's going to be effectively enforced anyplace.
Right.
So I just think that it's the wrong message. The message has to be that secrecy is sacrosanct, and that message has to be given this week as part of the get-out-the-vote get-out-the-vote effort.
Okay, well, my next stop is to try to see what the Defense Department has to say about this.
Right. So. Okay, well, I'll be interested in reading that.
Okay, and listening if we can get anyone to talk. So thank you very much for your time
okay.
and for the input here and for defending democracy.
Well, thank you.
Right, bye.